All right. I also have these suggested reading lists that Mark passed out last week, and there's a bunch up here. And you guys can grab one of these after if you'd like one. I thought it might be helpful to bring some of the books that are on this reading list, and so I brought some of them. And one in particular I wanted to highlight for you is The Case for Faith. This is a fun, easy read. And on the course overview, there's a list of suggested readings that kind of accompany what we've covered the prior week. So if you feel like you want to review kind of what we've been talking about and maybe grasp a little bit more, this would be a great book for you to read over the summer, and you can just follow along with us in this book, The Case for Faith. It's Lee Strobel interviewing a bunch of top scholars in their field, so it's very conversational and a pretty interesting read. I have a few other books I brought just so you can look at them and see them and say, hey, maybe that's a book I'd want to check out. I'll highlight a few for you. One is this one, The Blackwell Companion to Natural Theology. This is an expensive book, but it's also probably the most powerful series of arguments for God's existence that's ever been written and probably will be written for some time now. So this is a very advanced book, but if you're interested in reading something and maybe pushing yourself a little bit, this would be a great one to get. Yeah.
Does it talk about intelligent design at all?
Yeah, I believe it does. So it talks about all sorts of stuff. So there's a few other books if you want something a little bit less intense. Reasonable Faith is a great book. Check out, or Scaling the Secular City by JP is a great one. So lots of books over here. You can check them out after and see if there's any that might interest you. I've got a little bit of a cold, so excuse me, bear with me. All right, so last week Mark began, and he said we are starting kind of at the top of this pyramid, starting talking about Jesus, and we are going to begin and end focusing on who is Jesus. And I think that's a great way to do it, a good reminder just that when you're having conversations with people about God's existence, about you're having conversations about who God is in reality, it's always a good idea to bring it back in some way to Jesus. That's the goal of our conversation, right? To help people come to a real relationship with Christ, to care for them in a way that helps them be led to that point. So that's where we're beginning and ending. And today I'm wrapping us back down to here. And we're starting with some more foundational issues. And so for the next few weeks, we'll be talking about some different arguments for God's existence and talking about how can we know that God exists. And then we'll cover a few other issues that are kind of issues that are going to probably come up if you're having these sorts of conversations with people. Issues like, is there really an eternal hell? And would God be loving and just to send people to an eternal hell? That's a big issue that may come up if somebody may have an objection to Christianity. So we're going to be able to answer some of those objections, and then we'll end our course coming back to Jesus. So that's kind of our plan for the course. And today we're going to begin that plan by looking at what's called the cosmological argument for God's existence. And cosmological is a big word that just means the argument from the universe. It's from the universe. The fact that the universe exists, the cosmos exists. So therefore, how can we move from that point to the fact that God exists? And I want to just remind you of something Mark said last week. And Mark talked about the difference between knowing that Scripture is true, that Jesus, that God is real, that the Bible is true, and showing that God exists. And so the difference between that is important to understand, because sometimes you start talking about this stuff and you think, man, how could any normal person have confidence in who God is? How could it, you know, and we know people throughout history, you know, some of the most devout people who've been followers of Christ and followers of Jesus are people who maybe don't have access to these sorts of intellectual arguments that we're talking about today. So the way that ultimately we know who God is by the witness of his Holy Spirit in our own hearts. It says in Romans 8:16, the Spirit himself bears witness with our spirit that we are God's children. And so we can have deep knowledge of God and deep trust in Him that is rational, just because the God's Spirit is within us and testifies to our spirit, that we have this inner confirmation of the Holy Spirit that we are God's children. But the way that we show that Christianity is true and help explain that to others, the pattern that we see throughout Acts and throughout the New Testament is by rational argumentation. And Mark talked about 1 Peter 3:14 that says, have no fear of them, but in your hearts honor the Christ as the Lord, as holy, always being prepared to give a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you. Yet do this with gentleness and respect. So in that passage, you see he says, have no fear of them. And then he gives two ways that you cannot have fear. And the first way is to honor Christ the Lord as holy, that in your heart you are committed that Jesus is my master, he's my king, I'm following him, I'm honoring him, he's the one I'm seeking. But then secondly, it says always being prepared to make a defense. That word is apologia in Greek, the Greek word that we get apologetics from. A defense, it means a rational argument to anyone who asks you a reason for the hope that is in you. And so that's what we are trying to accomplish here. And we're going to do that by looking at creation. And there's one other passage I wanted to point out before we get into this argument. That's in Romans 1:18. And this is dealing specifically with creation. It says this: for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made, so they are without excuse. So what that means is that every person has certain innate knowledge of God's existence just through creation. Just through creation. Now, we may not know about Jesus, right? But it says here we know about God's eternal power and divine nature. So we have this certain knowledge. Man, there is a creator. There is a powerful creator who has this eternal power, who's created everything. And we know that just through creation. And it says that the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth. So when somebody is disbelieving in God, they are suppressing the truth that God has revealed to them through creation. And I think this is an encouragement to us as believers, because it means that when we share the gospel and we share the truth about who God is, we're sharing with somebody something that they already have knowledge of deep down. We're reinformed, we're helping bring that up and causing them to be confronted with something they already know. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. So, excuse me. So we are going to look at the argument for the beginning of the universe and the argument for God's existence from the beginning of the universe. And this argument we're going to go through has kind of three steps. And we start with the universe, which exists. We know the universe exists. And then we're going to say, does the universe have a beginning or no beginning? We'll argue that the universe has a beginning. And then we'll say that that beginning was either caused or uncaused. And we'll argue that it was caused. And then we'll talk about whether that cause was personal or impersonal. And we'll argue that it was personal. We'll explain what that means as we go down the list and get there. So that's kind of the basic argument. And as we cover it, just for the way we state it, we're going to do it a little bit out of order. We're going to start with the kind of the cause of the universe, then talk about the beginning, and then come back to it being personal. So on your outline, the cosmological argument, the three points there, if you want to write them down, are the first one: we're starting the universe has a beginning. The beginning of the universe was caused, and the cause of the beginning of the universe is personal. And as we cover it, like I said, we're going to do it in a different order. So the big bold number one on your sheet, if you're taking notes, is whatever begins to exist has a cause. Whatever begins to exist has a cause. And we're going to kind of build this argument kind of in a formal way, so that if you believe the premises, then the conclusion must follow. So whatever begins to exist has a cause. Now, let's think about that premise. That seems to be, I mean, you think about this. If you got home today after the church picnic, you walked into your house and you saw a horse in your living room, would you think, oh, it just popped into existence here? No, we wouldn't. How did this horse just happen to come into existence? We wouldn't know. None of us would think that. We would think, how did this horse get here? What happened? Somehow this horse had to get in here. What happened? And so because none of us think about anything as beginning to exist. And so a magician pulls a rabbit out of his hat. At least in that case, you've got the magician in the hat. But in the case of the universe, we're talking about something coming into existence from nothing. From absolutely nothing. Not just empty space. It's coming into existence from literally nothing. And so this first premise I should write it down so we can keep track of where we're at. Whatever begins to exist has a cause. This first premise is universally verified by our experience constantly. Something cannot come into being from nothing. And some people might say, well, the universe can come into existence from nothing. I mean, you can try to say that. But the question, if you say that, what makes nothingness so discriminatory that only universes can pop into existence? Right? Why is nothingness so discriminatory that we can't have like dogs popping into existence and other things popping into existence? What is it about nothingness that makes it say, nope, it's just universes that are going to pop into existence? So whatever begins to exist has a cause. This, I think, is just universally verifiable. It's constantly verified by our experience. And, there's not many people who really argue against this point. And the arguments I've heard against it, there's some people who say that in physics, sometimes that there's these subatomic particles called virtual particles that come into being from nothing. And the reality is, though, that they don't come into being from nothing. They are the result of a fluctuation of energy inside of a vacuum, which I don't totally understand, and we all probably don't. But the reality is it's not coming into being from nothing. It's coming into being in a certain state. And so we're talking about coming into being from nothing. So whatever begins to exist has a cause. If something begins to exist, has a cause. The other question you'll hear about this premise all the time is, well, what about God? What about God? Why doesn't he have a cause? What caused God? And if you hear that question, first of all, that question actually doesn't make sense. What caused God? Because God, by his very definition, is uncaused. He's not caused. He's uncaused. He's the unmoved mover, the uncaused cause. And so asking what caused God is actually what's called a category fallacy. A category fallacy. It's like asking how many inches long is the smell of a rose, right? It's asking a question that doesn't make sense of the thing you're asking about it. It's using the wrong categories. And so asking what caused God doesn't really make sense. And God, we know, is the uncaused cause. He exists outside of space and time. And so it's really an incoherent question. So that's the first step. Whatever begins to exist has a cause. The second step is that the universe began to exist. And we are going to spend most of our time on this premise this morning. Yeah.
I just wanted to point out, like, an easy way for me to understand what you were saying, like, who caused God, is to look at it that there. It's impossible to have an infinite regression.
We're going to talk about that right now. Good segue. Yeah. All right. So, the universe began to exist. And so we're going to talk about four arguments for this premise that the universe began to exist. Two arguments will be philosophical in nature, and then two arguments will be scientific in nature. So we'll start, there's A, B, C, D, and so we're gonna start with A there. the first philosophical argument. And this is going to get a little crazy, but it's okay. We'll be all right. You ask questions, we'll go on. It's A is the non-existence of actual infinite E. The non-existence of actual infinity. Now, let's talk about this. Here's what we're talking about. We're talking about showing that the universe had a beginning. So if the universe did not have a beginning, then let's have a timeline, and this P will be the present moment, and we're moving forward. And so this is a timeline of the universe, and let's say that the universe did not have a beginning. That means there's no starting point, right? There wouldn't be a starting point. Instead, this line would extend on forever. And so what we are trying to show is that, no, there was a starting point to the universe. And so that's kind of what we're showing. And the first way we're showing is by showing that an actual infinite could not exist. And that's important because if you're saying that the universe had no beginning, you're saying that the past is actually infinite. There was an actual infinite number of moments that have occurred in the past. Does that make sense? If the universe is past eternal, then there is an actual infinite number of moments that have occurred. And so to understand this concept a little bit more, we need to understand the nature of infinity. And so there's two different concepts of infinity that mathematicians work with. There's what's called potential infinity. Potential. I'm just gonna abbreviate. Potential infinity, and then there's actual infinity. And potential infinity is symbolized by sideways 8. And actual infinity is symbolized by the Hebrew letter Aleph with a little knot by it. So you have, this is potential infinity and actual infinity. It's called Aleph knot is the way they symbolize it. And so let's talk about these two different concepts of infinity. So potential infinity says if we took the distance from me to the end of the room, we could divide that in half. And then we could divide that portion in half. And then we could divide that portion in half. And divide that portion in half. And we could potentially keep dividing that in half on into infinity. That is potential infinity. We could potentially do that. And actual infinity is here's the technical definition. A number of members already in the collection is greater than any finite number. Or a part of the set can be equal to the whole set. And this is actually a defined, well-developed concept in mathematics and in set theory. And so, for example, you can have the set of all natural numbers. So this would be a set that is actually infinite, right? There's an actual infinite number of numbers in that set. But the problem with an actual infinite, the reason that it can't exist in reality, is because all sorts of absurdities would occur if it did. And let me just give you a few examples. All right, we need some more room here. So one example would be, here's the set of natural numbers. Let's subtract from this the set of odd numbers. How many numbers would be left? Infinite. Yeah, you'd have an actual infinite, right? There'd still be an actual infinite number of numbers. But let's try it again. So you have this one, you have an actual infinite minus an actual infinite equals an actual infinite. Okay? But we can also do this. We could have the set of all natural numbers minus the set of all natural numbers greater than 4. Then you have an actual infinite minus an actual infinite equals what? 3. You see, and that's mathematically showing some absurdities. Let me just give you some other ideas. If an actual infinite could exist, then a person who wrote his own autobiography and took 1 year to write about each day could actually finish his biography. If he took a whole year to write about every day and an actual infinite could occur, then theoretically he could write his own autobiography and finish it. There's other examples of that kind of show this. A big famous one is called, you think about a library with an actual infinite number of red books and black books. Okay, let's say they have, and let's say somebody checked out all the red books. Every other book is red. And they checked out all the red books. Guess what? You just checked out an actual infinite number of books, but there's still an actual infinite number of books left in the library. Okay, so these puzzles just serve to show that in reality, an actual infinite can't exist. It's a concept in our minds and that mathematicians can use, but it doesn't exist in reality. And this is important because that means that timeline that we were looking at can't go back indefinitely. There has to be a beginning point. There has to be a beginning point because an actual infinite can't exist. Any questions so far?
So can someone use, or is this a category of fallacy, then you're trying to show at the beginning of the universe, but then isn't God an actual infinity?
So when we speak of God being infinite, we're not speaking of him numerically or quantitatively, we're speaking of him qualitatively, that he is qualitatively perfect in all of his respects, and not that he has an actual numerical infinite number of parts or something like that.
But if you're going to get into this theoretical discussion with something about the universe, could they also then apply that to God's existence?
I understand what you're saying, but the reason that this would not apply to God's existence is because we're talking about an actual infinite succession of moments throughout time, and what we're arguing for is that there's a boundary to time, and that God exists outside of time. So God has not endured an actual infinite number of successive moments. So I don't think that would apply to God. So some people some theologians might say God has an actual infinite number of ideas or thoughts, but even that I think is probably not accurate description of God's knowledge. Anyway, any other questions? Sorry, I don't know if I answered that one. Okay.
Well, instead of being scientific about that answer, can we just call that the mystery of faith?
You could, but that might not be too too pleasing
too
to somebody. Somebody's asking questions.
Are there scholars who talk about an actually infinite past and the nature of time and talk about those things together? Who are not believers to try and? Because it seems to me if the past is actually infinite, it's like walking up a down escalator to stay in the present.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It is well discussed in the literature, but I don't think that there's any scholars who make a good argument for an actual infinite possibly existing in reality. So, yeah.
So if there's no infinite past, what about infinite future? Because you know, we're eternal.
Oh, good question.
Yeah.
That's a great question. So the difference is that the future has not yet occurred yet, right? The past has already happened, okay? But the future is not yet occurred, so we are heading into the future. So that's potential infinite, because we have a potential to go on forever and ever and continue without, and we will, I believe. It hasn't already occurred. We're saying to say that this has no beginning is to say that an actual infinite number of moments has already occurred,
right.
And that means they have become real. And so, you think about that. How would you ever get to the present moment? How could you do that? And okay, now I'm jumping ahead. That's the second. This is the second argument. Let me go to argument B. The argument B, the second one, is the impossibility
of traversing and actual infinite.
So, you think about it, if the series of past events is actually infinite, how would we ever arrive at the present moment? To get to the present moment, you would have had to cross over an actual infinite number of moments successively. And to across that means we would have to actually be able to cross infinity, and then the present, how would we get to the present moment? The present moment would never arrive, and that's absurd, because here we are, right? And so it's impossible to traverse an actual infinite. And you think about it, you can never count to infinity because there'd always be one more number, right? But if I told you to count down from infinity, from negative infinity to zero, and told you, you couldn't even get started, right? It's like trying to jump out of a bottomless pit. There's no place even to start. And so that's another tremendous problem with saying that the universe is past eternal, is that you could never traverse an actual infinite to arrive at the present moment. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. All right. I know we've been talking about infinity and math. This has been kind of crazy. So any other questions on this? We're going to move on to the scientific arguments next. But any?
Doesn't this discussion fall into that area of the foolishness of men trying to discuss the actualness of God? I mean, because when he talks about Romans 1:20, which we read, he doesn't talk about infinities and things like that. He just talks about looking at nature.
Right. That's true. And I think he's saying that all men have some knowledge of God in their hearts through nature. But that knowledge is limited. It's not, it's to his eternal power and divine nature. And I also think that this is an argument that the really cool thing about this argument is that it's been around hundreds of years. This is not a new argument. But now it's being confirmed scientifically by a number of things. And so, just like Paul did in Acts chapter 17, when he went to Athens, he appealed to their own philosophers and the things they already had accepted as being true, and built an argument for God's existence and for the truth of the gospel from a common base point. And I think that's something that an area that we can use this in, is kind of saying, we all believe in the universe, we all believe, and it seems to make sense that the universe began to exist. And so that's where we're headed. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Could not God have, done actual events, all the way back, before he made the earth and the universe? What about the angels? Were they made before the earth and the universe?
Yeah, I do think they were made. We don't know when the angels were made.
Yeah.
They were made before the Garden of Eden, obviously, because Satan's already there. They exist, but I think we're talking about the beginning of time itself. And so that I think angels would have to occur.
Whatever God defined as a moment by doing something, wouldn't that be an actual moment? So should he theoretically be an actual infinite?
No, I don't think God's an actual infinite. I think, like I said, when we talk about God being infinite, we're talking about that he is qualitatively perfect in all respects. Not that there's some numerical truth to God's being. So, anyway, so we got to move on to the scientific arguments. And like I said, these arguments are hundreds of years old, and they have been, yeah.
I was just going to say, I'm sorry.
Go for it.
But about the creation of angels, it's in Job 3, 4 through 7, and he says that God created the angelic beings before the creation of the world. And when God talks to us as humans, he always uses the creation of the world or the foundation of the earth as a starting point for us to say.
Boom. Okay, yeah, so, yeah. Job 38 talks about the creation of the heavenly host angels. All right, so let's move on to scientific evidences for the beginning of the universe. Probably the most well-known scientific evidence for the beginning of the universe is Big Bang cosmology. The Big Bang. And we're going to talk through that a little bit. Let me talk about the history of it a little bit. So Einstein developed his theory of relativity that predicted that either the universe was blowing up like a balloon or collapsing in on itself. And he hypothesized that there must be some force keeping the universe in check so that this was not the case. But in the 1920s, two physicists named Alexander Friedman and George Lemaître both independently came to the conclusion that the universe was expanding. And this view has been confirmed time and again to be probably one of the most confirmed things in science, that the universe is expanding. There's a few different evidences for this. One is what's called background radiation. Background radiation means that if you take a radio antenna and you aim it up anywhere into space, you won't hear complete silence. Instead, you'll hear, like, you'll hear a certain amount of energy and heat that is residual in the universe in any direction that you point a radio antenna. And that background radiation is predicted by a universe that is expanding, because at some point in the finite past, it means that there was a enormous explosion of power and energy. And this is what's important. The Big Bang teaches that not just like that it was space back there and there was like a big clump of matter and it came and it exploded outward creating everything. It says that time and space itself came into a being at a finite point in the past. So the Big Bang theory says that time itself began. And so kind of the picture you have is of, you have time on one side and space on another. And you have time, as time goes on, space starts expanding, but there is a finite point in the past at which time itself begins. There's a boundary to space and time in the past. And as you go back in time, just like a balloon, if you had a balloon with a bunch of dots on it, imagine that, and we started deflating it, eventually all of those dots would come to the same point, and that's called the initial singularity that cosmologists refer to. And so so that's the Big Bang theory. It says that about 13.7 billion years ago, that space, time, and matter all began from this initial singularity. Now, what's the first verse of the Bible say?
In the beginning,
what?
God created
the heavens and the earth. Now, what's amazing here is that the very first verse of the Bible says, in the beginning, which is time, God created the heavens, which is space, and the earth, which is matter, right? And we have this very first verse of the Bible that is saying exactly what science is now, at the highest levels, is predicting the way the universe began. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and they're saying there was a finite point in the past at which space, time, and matter came into being and has been radiating outwards from the center of the universe since then. Does that make sense? Which is super exciting. There was I wish I had the quote with me, I forgot it, but there's a NASA astronomer named Robert Jastrow, and he has a famous quote that says that it's as if scientists have scaled the highest peaks of knowledge and got to the final peak, and as they pull themselves over the last peak, they pull themselves up to find a band of theologians who've been sitting there for centuries. the Big Bang theory is very much confirming of the creation of the universe and that the universe began to exist. And this is by far the most accepted view. Nobody today holds what they used to hold before these calculations were made, that would say that the universe is a so-called steady state model, that the universe is just in a steady state of existence and is past eternal. Nobody says that today, because that view has been universally rejected as information has come about. And so another piece of evidence that is lended to the Big Bang Theory is what Edwin Hubble discovered, who the Hubble Space Telescope's named after, and it's called the red shift. And what Hubble discovered is that if you look at every other galaxy and star that we can see, that the when you look at them, their color is shifted towards the red side of the color spectrum. And the reason that he calculated that it is shifted, and it's shifted in proportion to the distance the star is from us. And so what you get is that the universe is expanding, and because those stars are all moving away from us, that means that shows us that red shift. And so this has been confirmed time and again. Now, there have been, you'll hear about, and if you read the news or whatever, there have been physicists and scientists who have tried to come up with theories that explain away this beginning of the universe, because it's kind of uncomfortable for them. And so you'll hear about that sometimes. There used to be a trend kind of talking about an oscillating universe that would look like this. It's kind of like, yeah, there was a big bang, but then there'll be a big crunch. It'll come all back together, and then it'll bang out again. And that's going to go on for infinity. And so there's this oscillating universe. That view has a number of problems and is not, and also it requires a beginning. One of the biggest problems is that it has an entropy problem. So it would more so look like this. It would grow over time, and so it still requires a beginning. There's an inflationary model that still requires a beginning, a quantum gravity model that still requires. I've been reading about this all week, and trust me, you do not want me to go too far on this. Stephen Hawking, you probably know who he is. He's like the physicist who's paraplegic, quadriplegic, and he attempted to describe a beginningless universe recently in a book, and the way he did it was by taking the mathematical number I. Anybody 5 points know what I stands for?
Negative.
Yeah, it's the square root of -1. And so for those of you who've been out of high school math for like 40 years, like me, you get a square root, 2 times 2 is 4. And so the square root of 4 is 2. But nothing times itself could equal -1, right? A negative times a negative is a positive. And so this is an imaginary number, it's called. It's a kind of something that mathematicians use to kind of do calculations in mathematics. But Stephen Hawking took this square root of -1 and in his equations made it stand for something that would stand for time in reality. And that just doesn't make sense for an imaginary number to stand for anything in reality. So, in fact, in 2003, there were three physicists, Bohr, Vilenkin, and Guth, and they were able to prove, and they have this theorem called the Bohr-Guth-Vilenkin theorem, and they proved that very basic assumptions. They didn't even take Einstein's equations into account. So Einstein's equations could change on their view. But they will prove that almost every model of a universe that is used today requires a beginning. And this theorem applies in such a broad theorem. It applies to almost every model that exists. So Alexander Vilenkin said, it is said that an argument is what convinces reasonable men, and proof is what it takes to convince even an unreasonable man. With the proof now in place, cosmologists can no longer hide behind the possibility of a past eternal universe. There is no escape. They have to face the problem of a cosmic beginning. So, Big Bang cosmology points to a beginning of the universe. So, that's our third argument for the universe's beginning.
Which would explain why Hawking, as an atheist, would try to want to put a number on it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Any other questions about the Big Bang?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just got a question. When you said that the universe is expanding, do you mean that it's everything that's it's not literally expanding, or it was it was made and we're just having the ability to discover how big it is.
No, it's literally expanding. Every star is moving away from every other star. I think if you talk to physicists, what actually is happening is that space is receding from itself, and it's not that matter is expanding, but it's expanding. So yes, every star, if you look out, every star, and so what scientists tell us the future of the universe is that the universe will ultimately experience what's called a heat death, so that every star will continue to move away from every other star. Eventually, all matter will break down. There won't be any matter left. The universe will collapse into a series of black holes, and everything will be completely cold, and will reach a point of maximum entropy, where everything is completely separated from everything else, and the universe will, you know, no life will be possible at all, because no matter will exist. And so that's where the universe is heading as it continues to expand. Yeah.
So where's the center of that?
The center of the universe? They do try to calculate the center of the universe. I don't know where.
Right here.
I'm sorry, what's that?
Is it quantifiable using radio waves or the redshift, or how do they?
The beginning of the universe?
No.
Yeah, it's totally quantifiable. So they mean. Yeah, they can calculate the speed at which the universe is expanding, and I don't know, I'd have to follow up on how they do that. Okay, one more question.
Does anyone know anything about like a death of a black hole? Is that possible?
I don't know. That's a good question. You should check out that Black Hole Companion to Natural Theology. Okay. All right, let me go on to the last argument for the beginning of the universe, and that is what's called, we just kind of talked about a little bit, entropy. This is the second law of thermodynamics. And what this says is that in a closed system where there's no matter or energy entering from the outside, that the amount of useful energy is constantly running out. And you can just, you can see this with a cup of hot water. You fill up a cup of hot water, it begins to cool down. The universe tends towards disorder, and the universe is running out of heat and energy, and that's something that's constantly happening in a closed system. So it's heading towards a heat death. They actually say that the heat death will occur at 10 to the 30th power years. So that's a long time away. We got some time, but don't worry about it. So that's a one with 30 zeros after it, that number of years. But at that point, here's what actually will be. There'll be 90% dead stars, 9% supermassive black holes formed by the collapses of galaxies, and 1% atomic matter in the state of hydrogen. Eventually, protons will decay into positrons. Galaxies, the distance between each electron and positron will be the size of our present galaxy. So that's what our universe is expanding towards. Now, if it's expanding towards that and the energy is running out, that means it had to have an injection of energy and order at some point in the finite past. Like a clock being wound up. It's running down, and at some point, there had to be a point where it was wound up. And so this is the law from the confirmation from the second law of thermodynamics. Does that make sense? All right. So, whatever begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist. Therefore, the universe was caused. That must follow. If whatever begins to exist has a cause and the universe began to exist, then we know that the universe was caused. Now, what can we know about the cause of the universe? Well, for one, because he's causing space, time, and matter itself, we know that he must be spaceless, timeless, and immaterial. What else can we know about him? Well, I think we can know that he is a person. And let me tell you how. There are only two types of causation that we know. The first type of causation is called
event-event causation.
And this is the type of causation that happens when a baseball hits a window, causes the window to break. Okay? There's a one event causes another event, right? And with the beginning of the universe, if you had this sort of event-event causation, the problem is there's always an earlier event that's causing the next event, right? And so it would lead to an infinite regress. That's what it's called, an infinite a problem that, man, what was that first cause? What began it all? But the other type of causation that we know of is called agent causation. And this is the type of cause that happens when I lift my hand up freely and pick up my cup of water. It's that when a free agent freely makes a decision and chooses something. And that's the only type of causation we know that isn't an event-event sort of causation. And so the beginning of the universe couldn't be this event-event causation, so it must be an agent causation. So that means that the beginning of the universe must have been caused by a person, somebody who can make free choices. Free acts are spontaneous and only caused by conscious beings. And so we have the universe is caused by somebody spaceless, timeless, immaterial, personal. I think we can all safely say that the universe was caused by somebody enormously powerful. I wouldn't, for the sake of this argument, I wouldn't say go as far as saying omnipotent or all-powerful, but I'd say clearly if somebody can create the universe, they're enormously powerful. And finally, they must be extremely intelligent, right? This sounds a lot like God, doesn't it? And so the ultimate conclusion is that the universe was caused by an uncaused, personal, conscious creator with free will who was enormously powerful and intelligent. Of the world's major religions today, that would leave us with Judaism, Islam, Christianity, and deism. We haven't gotten to the truth of Christianity with this. That's where we're headed. But we have gotten to, I think, a rational basis for believing that God exists. Any other questions?
Why don't you think that the cause was the multiverse? Is it subject to the events?
Right. So he's asking about what's called the the multiverse. And the multiverse is a theory some physicists have put forward. And it's not, it's very well developed in the literature. It's not like there's just like throwing out, hey, there's a multiverse. There's different ways of looking at the multiverse, and there's some of those ideas of a universes that I mentioned of the early beginning of the universe that talk about multiverses, and they have all these crazy pictures of, you know, our universe existing like this, but then there's other universes that are like that, kind of going off the side, and then there's other ones down here, and anyway, they have all these crazy pictures of the multiverse. So I think that the multiverse is incredibly speculative, and I think what happens, honestly, is that physicists reach this kind of boundary point, and they start speculating. And what's happening is they're moving out of their own discipline and into the discipline of metaphysics and philosophy, where thinkers have been thinking about some of these issues for a long time. And so I think it's really, the multiverse is mostly speculation by people who are not operating in their field very much. And the Bohr-Guth, the Lincoln Theorem that I mentioned, eliminates most of those theories. So anyway, that's...
But at the end of the day, does it even matter? You're still stuck with the same issues.
A multiverse? Yeah, I mean, they might say that, yeah, I agree. I think you're still stuck with the same issues. They would say, because, you know, the issue is they're saying, you know, there's multiple universes that exist, but the problem is all these universes would have a boundary to space and time.
Right.
Exactly.
And so they would all be, it would be separate universes starting from a singularity. It doesn't matter.
Doesn't eliminate the concept.
Right.
It doesn't change it.
Yeah.
I would think that for an unbeliever who understands all of this and knows that we're headed towards entropy, it would be very depressing that there is no hope for the future, and that that would be a good way to bring in that there is hope, because we know that if God is, if there is a person who is spaceless, timeless, what is it, immaterial, personal, powerful, and intelligent, he can turn the whole thing around.
Yeah.
Which he does in Revelation, we know he does.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think, yeah, I mean, there is no hope on a naturalist, atheistic worldview, because there is, you know, you even have movies like Interstellar, I don't know if you saw that, where he's like trying to escape and like trying to like go to like a planet. Ultimately, there is literally no hope, because every atom will be a galaxy's length from every other atom. There's no hope in an environment like that. And so that's where the universe is heading. And so I do think it doesn't make any sense to say that there you can't have, it's hard to have a rational basis for meaning in life apart from a theistic worldview. There's a chapter in this book called The Absurdity of Life Without God that goes into detail on that argument that would might be interesting. This is reasonable faith.
I read an article about some physicists a few years back that actually came to Christ because they cannot explain that singularity. They gave up and said,
oh,
this has to be the reason. God does exist.
Yeah, there are lots. I mean, physicists, you know, you have different disciplines. In the discipline of biology, you tend to have people who are very staunchly atheistic, even though there's changing in some small circles. But in the discipline of physics, there is a ton of openness to theism and the belief in God's existence because of these very issues. Yeah. You got about 2 minutes. Any other questions?
So did sin then cause that? Because if God created the universe perfect and before sin, then if the universe torn itself apart, then it would have not pulled itself apart unless sin had come into existence.
Some people might try to argue that. My own personal view is that sin, the effects of sin were relegated to humans. And when you talk, when it says that, and so I think that sin impacted humans and allowed for human death. I don't know if I'd go so far personally as saying that entropy is a cause of sin. But
if there was no sin, then the universe would not destroy itself.
I don't know.
God,
I don't know that God created this universe to be eternal. He's going to create a new heavens and a new earth.
Right.
And I think that would be, that is eternal. And so I don't know that, anyway.
Where it says creation groans for the redemption, so how would that
yeah, I do think, I mean, creation itself groans for redemption. I think that creation itself experiences the effects of sin. You know, we see natural disasters and all sorts of things go on, and I think ultimately you can say those are due to sinful decisions, and maybe not even just human sinful decisions, but angelic sinful decisions, and that sin is in our world. So the created world does reflect the moral chaos that's going on, but I don't know that I would say that that is where the basis for entropy and the second law of thermodynamics. Just maybe it is. I just, you know, not prepared to say that. So.
Okay, so taking this to a practical application, are we at some point in time in this class, so the great theory is how many of us are going to actually have this conversation with 99%
yeah.
of the people?
Let me say, I agree. This is like, and let me say, I think some of our lessons are going to be less practical and some are going to be more practical. And I'd say that it's important, though, to have this, to have some of these ideas and concepts underneath our belt, just because it can strengthen our own faith and say, man, there are really good reasons to believe what we believe, and really intelligent things. And who knows? You may walk into Starbucks and find a physicist.
So. Well, how do you think all this root cause or something, so they can verbalize that they have no clue or whatever, and then maybe we can then turn them. Well, let me tell you. I can give you one practical way. I mean, somehow we're going to lead into the conversation, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what how you could start. I mean, you, as you understand this, like, well, how do you think the universe began to exist? how do you think that things came into being? I mean, do you think this is all here because it's always been here? Because that's not what science or most people would say. So
we need Byron's phone number for everybody to have.
Yeah.
I got to talk to this guy.
Good point. Okay. This will be our last question.
Apologetics as a discipline is, I believe, primarily for the Christian to strengthen their own faith in what they believe in, and also to understand where is the culture at on these issues, so when we do communicate and talk to people, we kind of know where they're at in a lot of these issues, but we also know where we are at in a lot of these issues, even if we don't go into all these details. I think it's still good for us to kind of allow ourselves to kind of work through these issues, even if it isn't at a super deep level.
Yeah, I agree. So next week, we're going to be starting talking about the design of the universe, and we'll touch on creation evolution. So excited for that. Let me pray for us as we go to church. Lord Jesus, thank you that you are good and kind to us. Thank you that you are intelligent, and Lord, that you have created a universe that is far beyond our comprehension. And yet, Lord, you've given us the dignity and the ability to be able to think and to reason through these things. And Lord, I pray that as we think about these things, even this week and after church, that you'd help us understand them. They might strengthen our faith and help us to trust you greater. And pray, Lord, that you would show us ways to put this into practical effect in our lives. That, Lord, that you would allow us to have meetings with people and to talk to people where we might be strengthened to be able to share our faith with them. Pray that you'd be honored in our lives and honored now as we go to church and learn from your word. In Jesus' name, amen.